We're all very familiar with the ins and outs of the developments that have created the banking crisis. And what I want to do is to try to set these into an evolutionary scheme of things to show where I think crucial points have led the banking system to take certain decisions which have brought us to this pass. And it may shock you that I want to start actually with the very earliest aspects of banking, the primal trick that the banking system played, and that was in getting us to accept claims on what was earlier thought of as money in lieu of the money itself. In other words, to substitute first banknotes and then bank deposits for hard cash. Now, the point that I want to make I have a couple of points I want to make in going back to that episode. It was more than an episode, it was an era of banking. And the first is that to make that substitution entails placing a divide between the thing claimed on and the claim. In other words, deposits were not originally seen as perfect substitutes for cash. They were something very different. As late as Hawtrey, he titled one of his books Money and credit was bank deposits to him. Now we think of credit as being on the other side of the bank balance sheets, but to Hawtrey, this kind of funny money, bank deposits, deserved a special name, which owed allegiance to its origins. Now, the important thing about this substitution of a claim on money for money itself is, as I say, that it introduces a separation and that it took an extraordinarily long time to establish. A time in which small banks arose and then consolidated and formed branches and formed links with London and the rise of the discount houses and all the stuff that you might know if you've ever looked at monetary history. And it involved a kind of trial and error to discover how far you could push your luck, because the essential quality of this substitution was the risk of not being able to convert bank money into the real stuff, money proper, as Keynes called it as late as 1930. And it was against this convertibility risk that banks held liquid assets. Now, the process of arranging this substitution, of getting us to accept bank deposits as just as good as money itself, took a long time and was fraught with failure. The statistics on bank failures are in the paper. They are quite impressive. There were a lot of them. And it took, especially incidentally and interestingly, over the Napoleonic Wars, when convertibility was suspended because banks overextended their lending and created too much funny money. Now, somehow the failures were surmounted and the process of substitution went on despite these failures. But just keep in mind that it took at least 200 years to accomplish what we now take for granted, which is that bank deposits are equivalent to government-supplied money. And that's a very important factoid. I mean, you can't put exact dates on it. But once that had been accomplished, and here comes the other reason for going back to that episode, once that had been accomplished, the relationship between the state and the money supply was fundamentally altered. And this is something which none of the discussion about current regulations seems to want to take on board, and I think this is very peculiar. The state was no longer the unique supplier of money once the substitution had taken place. And the state had a choice, which was either to collaborate with the banks in maintaining the exchange of state money for bank money at par, or to say, well, we wash our hands of this, caveat emptor, put your money where you think you should. It's none of our business. And they actually chose the former course. The choice entails everything we know about monetary policy, the lender of last resort, deposit insurance, the whole lot. Okay. Now, when we talk about what should be done in the present circumstance, the debate between, say, Mervyn King and John Kay on the one side and Gordon Brown, perhaps, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer on the other about the virtues or otherwise of narrow banking, this is where that relationship between the state and the money supply should come up as part of the discussion. Where does the state stand in its pseudo-guarantee, which is it has maintained now for a very long time, to help the banks exchange deposits for money at par. Now, convertibility risk, the risk that banks might not be able to maintain that par exchange, is of course the origin for keeping liquid assets on the balance sheets, which they did for centuries. I mean, I'm old enough to have taught that kind of banking in my money and banking class, and a couple of other people in this room are too. But the history of the development of banking has been a history of squeezing liquidity off the balance sheet, because liquid assets are not nearly as profitable to hold as illiquid ones. Taking bigger and bigger risks, running down the liquidity cushion. And in the paper I explore various ways in which this is done. To stop it or forestall it, from time to time the liquid assets ratio was enforced, and then the lender of last resort facility made the banks chafe under this liquidity requirement, although they put up with it for quite some time. And then you had the extraordinary developments in which the banks' liabilities became closer and closer in people's minds to building society liabilities. Okay, the similarities were vexing to users, and various pressures were put to pass legislation, a whole series of acts, which made these two liabilities more similar to one another. And in addition to this, the reserve requirements, which the banks had but the building societies didn't, were made universal in 1971 with competition and credit control. So then the banks, who had pressed for this, they wanted to be a level playing field between themselves and the building societies, the banks were then thrown into very intense competition with the building societies. Okay. This then changed the asset portfolio of the banking system. Banks never used to do mortgages. It was too long term. It was too risky. The building societies did that, and they had in the building society movement a whole set of habits or customs or conventions which made this longer term financing that the building societies engaged in safer. Here they are, thrown into competition in 1971, and the liquid assets requirement was reduced at the same time, made universal and reduced. So the banks, as I say, responded by going into mortgages, and they also had to compete against the fact that the building societies offered interest rates on their, they were called shares then, but let's call them deposits, because that's what they felt like. And this squeezed bank profits. So liquidity again, you know, took a lower and lower profile in bank balance sheets. And finally, the source of liquidity to the banks, to the banks, really was the only thing left to them, and that was their loan book. Securitization had already been invented in the US, wasn't much in use here until about 1985, something like that. But they began to use this as a source of making their formerly illiquid assets, their loan book, liquid when they needed to. I commented on this at a conference in 1990. The date is important, which is why the verbal presentation is more important than the publication date three years later. I characterize securitization as the sixth stage of banking. This is building on work that I had done over the years. What I said was this. In one sense, securitization represents a complete change in the traditional style of banking, but it can be seen as a logical development of the paring down of liquidity that has occurred steadily through earlier stages of development. Devising assets that can be sold if required, but which are more profitable, perhaps, than the government securities that used to play such a major role in banks' contingency plans, leaves the banks less vulnerable than they were when ultimately completely reliant on the lender of last resort. That's pretty mild stuff, but with the benefit of hindsight, it is such a wonderful thing. Of course, one sees it rather differently. This bland phrase about a complete change in the traditional style of banking has indeed come to pass, and has led to what I call in the paper the great mutation. We've had the great moderation and great other things, so why not the great mutation? And this mutation, I'm afraid, is cancerous. We all know that. So securitization did bring in a complete change in the traditional style of banking. And the role of Basel I, 1989, in further encouraging banks to securitize has again not been mentioned in these debates that are raging around us on how to re-regulate the banking system. I think it's terribly important. Basel I is a classic case of unintended consequences and regulation avoidance. The intention, I suppose, of Basel I was to get banks to hold a less risky portfolio, asset portfolio. The result was to increase securitization like mad. Okay? And not hold, get as much off the balance sheet that was heavily weighted in the risk-weighted assets as they possibly could. So Basel I accelerated the use of securitization in this country massively, in my view. The rest we know, the originate and distribute model has carried this securitization lark to its logical conclusions, and it has an additional flaw in that, of course, it relieves the banks of any obligation to monitor their loan book and their borrowers' accounts and so on, and to take responsibility for the repayment of loans. The rest you know, I'm not going to go into it. Our heads are full of it. The papers are full of it. Leave it. But so profitable was this new way of carrying on banking that banks found deposits an insufficient funding base, and further innovated by changing the liability side of their balance sheets to to include market-related sources of funding, which, because the suppliers of this funding are very sophisticated, highly hyperactive money managers, are much less secure than deposits from us docile folk. Okay, and the rest, again, you know. Now, I take some lessons from this little pot of history, which can be elaborated and developed in any way you choose, but you don't really need that, I think. The lessons. First, speed kills. As I said, that first substitution of a risky asset, banknotes and bank deposits, for hard money took 200 years to complete, during which there were many failures, quite massive ones. The transformation of banks from institutions that at least could what have I written here? It doesn't make any sense. Sorry about that. Could be sound. It's all right, actually. I just can't read. From institutions that at least could be sound into monsters out of control took at most 40 years, dating from competition and credit control, or 20, starting with Basel I. You choose. It's up to you. To be profitable, they have to create claims on an asset further up the hierarchy. Deposits are claims on cash, CDOs are claims on the collateral, and so it goes on. Right? Further and further distance is created between bank liabilities of various kinds and hard money. And with all of those steps that increase that distance, the really vital thing is that not all claims be exercised at once. And the reason we had a credit crunch is that the claims were exercised at once. We don't have that, or banks fail, which they did. Therefore, one must proceed to issue these kinds of assets gradually until one knows from experience what the market will absorb. So that's speed kill. Two, liquidity matters. The efficient markets hypothesis, by maintaining that markets are perfect, destroyed the notion of liquidity. Everything was equally liquid. Right? It's nonsense. Of course, it's not true. And the bubble has burst, and we know that. Interestingly, the Basel Agreement is not... the Basel I Agreement was not at all concerned with liquidity. It's all about capital adequacy. This is absurd. Is it because the liquidity cushion was already so lacking in stuffing that there was nothing to regulate? Or is it because they were taken in by the efficient markets hypothesis? Why was it that they were concerned with what, after all, is the last ditch, which is capital adequacy, and not with liquidity, which is your frontline defense? You know? It's very peculiar, but there it is. But liquidity does matter, and we know that. Secure funding matters. I have seen an article asking the question, I was flabbergasted by this, are there enough deposits? Enough deposits to keep banks afloat at the level to which they have recently become accustomed, in other words? Well, of course there aren't, which is what deleveraging tells us. We know that there aren't, but we know that we should go back to the point where that is the main basis of funding these institutions, not market funding. Responsibility for lending matters. That's so obvious, I don't really want to discuss it. Now, I'll just end with a little quotation that you all know. Worldly wisdom teaches that it is better for reputation to fail conventionally than to succeed unconventionally.